This is the NPR News Update for Wednesday, April 10th. News on your schedule. I'm Perry Vanelli. St. Paul Chamber Orchestra musicians will have to vote whether to ratify a tentative contract agreement with management. State House Democrats want to improve public education by increasing funding by $550 million. And we'll visit a small Minnesota farm to experience the birth of a new crop of lambs. After 6 months of a lockout, musicians and management of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra have a tentative contract deal. As UN Care reports, there are many details to resolve, but both sides expect to resume concerts as soon as possible.
The agreement came even as the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra Board was meeting in executive session to discuss canceling the rest of the orchestra season. Interim SPCO President Dobson West said when the message came through that musicians were open to a deal, it changed the whole character of the meeting.
I am delighted that we are truly, I think, on a path where we will very soon be able to get back to having concerts for this community. That's what everybody's goal has been, and I think we are finally getting to that point.
The agreement reached last evening states the musicians' negotiating committee will recommend players accept a management contract offer made last week. If approved, the contract will cut each musician's base salary by $15,000 a year.
It is a significant pay reduction.
Musicians Negotiating Committee member Carol Mason-Smith says the deal would also reduce the size of the orchestra from 34 members to 28. The reduction in numbers will be achieved through a retirement incentive package. The offer does include more artistic control of the orchestra for musicians. For management, it reduces costs by over $1 million a year, which it says it needs to keep the SPCO financially viable. This has been hard fought, and even now there are a series of steps until everything is settled. However, Smith says both sides agree the musicians' vote will not happen until after SPCO management reaches an agreement with the National Union, the American Federation of Musicians, or AFM, about broadcast and internet usage of SPCO material.
Because it said that the AFM proposal would come first, that allowed us to say, okay, we can follow that path and we can take it to ratification.
Both sides thanked St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman for his efforts to bring about the deal. Coleman admitted to wearing a broad smile at the news.
It's both a smile from sheer happiness and sheer relief because this really came down to the final hours and minutes.
The mayor says he recognizes how tough the negotiations have been for both sides.
The musicians were asked to take a lot of cuts in their pay and changes to the conditions of their contract, and that's always hard to do. And yet the society knew that the finances of orchestras are different than they used to be. Some of the resources that used to be there aren't there. And it's just not as easy to keep these things afloat.
Coleman says he knew, though, that if the sides kept at it, they could find a deal. Both management and musicians say they hope for a quick agreement with the AFM, followed by a musician's vote. That could be a challenge, though, because musicians who were not paid during the lockout have sought work in many other places. They will need to come back for the vote. This also raises the question of how soon concerts can restart.
I think everybody is focused on that issue.
Dobson West says SPCO concerts are currently cancelled through April 21st. No one can yet say for sure when the musicians might take the stage, but West and Smith say they want it to happen as soon as possible. Smith says the musicians have missed performing.
We're so looking forward to seeing our audiences. We haven't played together as an ensemble since February now. That's a long time. That's a long time.
And then, like the other people coming out of the SPCO offices, Carol Mason-Smith smiled. It was a tired smile and maybe slightly resigned, but it was there. UN Care, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Democrats in the Minnesota House are proposing an ambitious agenda for improving public education by raising taxes and increasing funding for schools by $550 million. DFL leaders claim that within 14 years, the plan will close the racial and economic achievement gaps that separate some students from their classmates. Tim Pugmire reports.
House Democrats are not taking aim just at the elusive achievement gap. They claim that a 100% graduation rate, all students reading by third grade, and 100% career and college readiness is also within reach. They've set 2027 as the target for those goals because that's the year students who begin kindergarten next year would be ready to graduate. DFL Representative Paul Marquardt of Dilworth, the chair of the House Education Finance Committee, said the bill would for the first time fund all-day kindergarten in every school district.
You've heard, if you've been in committee, study after study after study that shows the benefits of starting early. And, you know, the big point is, let's invest early to prevent the achievement gap rather than trying to spend billions of dollars trying to close it later.
That preemptive strategy also includes $50 million for preschool early learning scholarships targeted to low-income families. Schools would see a $209 per student increase in the basic funding formula. Funding disparities between property-rich and property-poor districts would be narrowed by about 10%. But Marquardt stressed that money alone won't guarantee results. He said that's why schools will be required to develop detailed plans for meeting performance goals and to review them annually. Marquardt said schools that fall short of goals will get assistance from the Minnesota Department of Education.
So we actually have assurances in the system that this isn't just going to be something on paper. We actually have a plan in place to make sure that the results are there with the resources we've provided.
The lead Republican on the House Education Committee had some kind words for a few of the provisions in the bill, but Representative Kelby Woodard of Belle Plaine said he has big concerns about the way Democrats would pay for their proposed education spending. The DFL plan relies on new taxes, including an income tax increase on wealthy Minnesotans. Woodard contends that lawmakers could help schools without raising taxes.
We know we've got an additional $1 billion in revenue coming in without addressing taxes. We'd like to fund some things in education without dipping into Minnesota's pockets and increasing their taxes. So we feel like Minnesota taxpayers are already overburdened. We don't feel that it's necessary to do that in order to do good things in education.
But Democrats disagree. House Speaker Paul Thiessen of Minneapolis said new tax revenue is essential. And when it comes to schools, Thiessen is convinced that the public supports the DFL approach.
Well, I think that there's no question that is the case. That's what people tell us all the time. They're willing to pay more as long as they know that the investments are going to go to things that work and are going to make a difference for our kids, but more importantly for the state of Minnesota in general. And I think that the proposals we see here today are absolutely going to do that.
House Democrats are also proposing to pay back about $850 million owed to schools from previous budget deals, but that provision, which relies on a separate and temporary tax on top earners, will be part of the House tax bill they plan to roll out later this month. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
In the past few months, Twin Cities home prices have been jumping as much as 16% over the same month a year before. But real estate experts and professionals disagree on how long prices will continue to rise so sharply. Annie Baxter has more.
If you talk to smart people about where they think the median home price is headed, you may get conflicting messages.
I think it's going to do that same thing until we get up to within about 90% of where the prices were back in the boom.
That's Dan Gross, a real estate investor. Over the past 35 years, he's bought and sold hundreds of Twin Cities homes, and he's convinced that the recent trend of double-digit annual price gains is sustainable. That's because of what's happening with supply. The supply of homes for sale in the Twin Cities is at its lowest point since 2004. The flow of foreclosed properties is dwindling, and homeowners who bought at the peak of the market may still be underwater and reluctant to sell at a loss. As a result, Gross and many realtors report multiple offers and bidding wars on homes. That makes Gross feel eager to list some properties he had been renting out.
The supply is just not there, and the demand is there with the low interest rates. I just think right now is the time to go for me. I don't believe that the market is going to level off. I believe it's going to keep going up.
Quinn Eddins disagrees. He's director of research at a firm called Radar Logic, which monitors home prices. Eddins says it's unlikely that price growth will follow a straight line up. That's partly because of what he thinks will happen with supply, particularly what's known as the shadow inventory. The term refers to homes that will likely wind up for sale in the foreseeable future.
There's enough latent supply in the wings in the form, on one hand, of distressed homeowners and foreclosures. But on the other hand, folks that have just been either unwilling or unable to sell, and as prices increase, you'll see those people once again being able to sell.
Once that happens, Eden says supply will catch up with demand and price gains will moderate.
Though you may see some price increases, I don't think 2013 is going to be another 2012.
That's also the view of the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, Narayana Kocherlakota. At a recent press event, Kocherlakota said he's not expecting a reversal of the price improvements, but he doubts prices will climb steeply this year. That said, he noted that prices are notoriously hard to predict.
Prices are determined by the mix of demand and supply. Actually forecasting exactly where those are going to be over the course of the a given year is very challenging.
And no matter how you frame it, the recovery will still take a while. If prices kept rising at recent rates, it would probably still take years to get back to the peak seen in the last housing boom. And that peak came in the middle of a bubble. So a full return to those price levels in the near future may not even be possible or desirable. Annie Baxter, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
A drop in demand for frac sand has given local leaders time to create regulations for the industry. Elizabeth Baer reports.
Around southeastern Minnesota, city and county leaders have spent the last year learning how to regulate the frac sand mining industry. Winona Assistant City Planner Carlos Espinoza says facilities that produce and process silica sand used in hydraulic fracturing or fracking were booming a year ago. But the frac sand rush has slowed as natural gas prices have dropped.
Because of the number of moratoriums and really the whole controversy in southeast Minnesota, there hasn't been sand really coming from Minnesota. The sand that we're seeing primarily would come from Wisconsin.
Espinoza says at least half of the frac sand operations in the city have stopped operations in the last 2 years. Industry analysts expect a resurgence in sand demand in a few years. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Winona.
This is the NPR News Update, available every day around noon, Minnesota's news on your schedule. This week, the U.S. Senate could begin debating expanded background checks for gun buyers, though it's not yet clear if the legislation will overcome a possible Republican filibuster. Brent Neely has more on how the gun control issue got bogged down in Congress.
In the weeks after the Sandy Hook killings, even many longtime supporters of gun rights in Congress said they were open to new gun regulations. First District DFL Congressman Tim Walz, who has been endorsed by the National Rifle Association, seemed open to supporting a ban on assault-style weapons and high-capacity ammunition clips in the days following the massacre.
It's not as if there have never been lines in the sand and things you can't own.
The powerful NRA's influence seemed to be slipping. The Democratic-controlled Senate moved quickly to hold hearings on gun violence.
Firearms were the leading cause of death for police.
But in the Republican-controlled House, gun control wasn't on the agenda. One of the few official responses to the Sandy Hook massacre in that chamber was a low-profile hearing on school safety in the Education Committee, chaired by 2nd District Republican John Klein.
Thank you for joining us for what is an important hearing, but one I wish weren't tied, frankly, to such an awful event.
The topic of gun violence was hardly raised in the hearing, which instead focused on mental health services and schools. The political strategy for Republicans was clear, says Robert Spitzer, a political scientist at the State University of New York in Cortland who studies gun control. Silence.
By and large, they would rather avoid troublesome, contentious issues. And, you know, the gun issue is one example.
President Obama has sought to keep up the pressure on Congress to do something, anything, as he did during a speech in Minneapolis in February.
But if there's even one thing we can do, if there's just one life we can save, we've got an obligation to try.
The campaign appears to have had little effect on lawmakers. In the Senate, where Democrats have control, measures to ban assault weapons and large ammunition magazines effectively died. Most Republicans and some Democrats wouldn't back either proposal. With those provisions going nowhere in the Senate, House members like Tim Walz, who might have been open to them, quickly reverted to opposing them. In the Senate, delay and filibuster threats go a long way, says Spitzer, who's the author of The Politics of Gun Control.
In the legislative process, it's a lot easier to stop things from happening than to get things to happen.
Spitzer says gun rights supporters, backed by the NRA and other pressure groups, have rallied their members in a way that gun control supporters haven't. That's despite public opinion polls showing widespread popular support for background checks and other restrictions on guns. Political analyst Stu Rothenberg says national polls are also a misleading indicator of whether Congress will support an issue.
You know, on one hand, you look at the national polls and you say, well, these members who are opposing gun control must be simply irrational. But if you look at their states and their congressional districts, most of them are acting extremely rationally. They're worried about primaries, general election defeats.
He says the way the congressional districts are drawn favors Republicans in rural and outer suburban areas, where guns are popular and that members are responding to their constituents. So where does this leave the ambitious gun control agenda that was laid out after the Newtown massacre? Any legislation that can make it through this Congress is likely to fall far short of what gun control advocates had hoped for in December. One such advocate is Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback, who's been active with the group Mayors Against Illegal Guns, that's financially backed by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. When asked if gun control supporters should have done something differently, Ryback says he's still holding out hope for a background check bill. As for the rest of the agenda,
eventually, I think common sense will prevail. It may take a while.
Ryback says he plans to keep campaigning against guns, even after he leaves office at the beginning of next year. The question is, will Congress still be paying attention then? Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
If Congress passes a universal background check law, what does that mean for the debate over gun control at the state capitol? As Brant Williams reports, Minnesota lawmakers continue to debate two competing background check bills.
States can pass gun laws that are more strict than federal gun laws, and they often do. For instance, Minnesota is more restrictive than the federal government when it comes to determining who is legally able to possess a firearm. However, when a federal gun law is more restrictive than state law, the state has to enforce the federal statute. Right now in Minnesota, it is legal for a person to buy a gun from a private seller without going through a background check. Congress could make that kind of transaction illegal by passing a more restrictive background check law. Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek says Congress should be careful about infringing on states' rights.
Many of the states in the union have said, look, we know what's best for our individual citizens, and so you get this push-pull between states' rights versus what the federal government may or may not want to do.
Stanek, a former Republican legislator, says he'd like to see lawmakers at both the state and federal levels focus on closing gaps in the national instant criminal background check system. He says only a quarter of states contribute mental health and criminal conviction data to the database. Stanek also says expanding background checks to include private sales will put more strain on the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the ATF.
Well, it's going to be another thing for the ATF to do. And the ATF has been very honest about this, saying we can't keep up with what we have now. You know, even just in Minnesota, they've got one agent for every 350 or 360 FFL dealers, which are the federal firearm licensed dealers.
A representative from the ATF declined to comment for the story. However, Scott Sweeto, special agent in charge of the ATF St. Paul branch, has said his division has 25 agents who are responsible for regulating firearm sales at more than 7,000 federally licensed dealers throughout Minnesota, Wisconsin, and the Dakotas. Several other states, including Colorado and Connecticut, recently passed universal background check laws, and some Minnesota legislators believe the same is possible here.
I remain confident that we can pass a universal background check provision in the Senate.
Senator Ron Latz, a Democrat from St. Louis Park, is the sponsor of a bill that would require most private gun sales to be subject to a background check. The bill is currently awaiting action in the Senate Rules Committee. Latz's bill is broader than a House proposal sponsored by St. Paul Democrat John Lesh. The Lesh bill, which is currently awaiting action on the House floor, covers only private gun sales that occur at gun shows. That means the two differing versions of background check legislation will likely have to be resolved in conference committee. House Public Safety Committee Chair Michael Paymar, who supports universal background checks, says Latz's broader Senate bill is the kind of legislation he'd like to see become law in Minnesota and across the nation.
The Latz bill is the companion of my original bill, so that's very much alive, and that's what, so for Minnesotans who want to do something about gun violence prevention, that's what people should be advocating for, is that bill emerging out of conference committee.
And if state legislators reject efforts to expand background checks, Paymar and other supporters will have to wait to see what comes out of Congress. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
In a speech at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. yesterday, Mayo Clinic CEO Dr. John Noseworthy said healthcare providers and policymakers have more work to do to create high-quality medical care at lower costs. Noseworthy said one of the ways to do that is to increase federal funding for scientific research.
The NIH invested more than $30 billion on medical research in 2012, and Mayo Clinic received approximately $220 million of that. Funding for the NIH and other agencies is critical to research, scientific discovery, technology, engineering, and math to strengthen our economy. It must be preserved.
Noseworthy said providers need to move quickly to put new medical knowledge into practice and use medical data to better understand the cost of care over time. He also said Congress needs to overhaul Medicare's payment structure, starting with changes to the formula that determines payments to doctors for Medicare patients. A team of educators leaves Minnesota today for an Arctic expedition aimed at gathering stories about climate change. University of Minnesota Professor Aaron Doring is leading the expedition called North of 60. He says the goal will be to collect stories about how life has changed for people living on Baffin Island in Canada.
We're actually working with the schools so that the students themselves can really sit down with their elders, gather this knowledge, share it with the world, building this tapestry of voices, and then at the same time we are collecting that and then sharing it with the world.
The expedition will last 2.5 weeks. The team will ski to several communities and carry all of their supplies on sleds. Doring is joined by two University of Minnesota PhD students and a geography teacher from Centennial High School in Circle Pines. And finally, spring brings new life to the landscape. Reporter Dan Gunderson visited a small Minnesota farm near Pelican Rapids to experience a yearly ritual, the birth of a new crop of lambs.
The sun is just peeking over the horizon when Joan and Dave Ellison pull on boots and warm clothes and walk across the frozen yard to the barn.
Generally, we come out at 6:30 to 7, 10, 2 to 3, 7, 10 to 11, and then in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock.
Joan enjoys the early morning. Her husband Dave, an emergency room physician, generally takes the 3 a.m. shift. It's important to check the sheep often. Mothers usually find a warm pile of straw in the barn to have their babies, but sometimes nature needs a little help.
The new moms will
sometimes do it on the run.
It's just amazing. We had a ewe that lambed on the top of the manure pile, and all of her babies rolled off the manure pile, and she stayed there and finished lambing. You know, the new moms are really, really stupid. But if they make it through that first year, they learn.
There are about 3 dozen new lambs so far. By the end of April, the Ellisons will have 60 to 70 lambs.
We usually have between 150 or 200% lambing. Partly that's because we have so many triplets.
Some genetic lines of sheep have more multiple births. The Ellisons even have a set of rare quadruplets this year. Dave Ellison says the new lambs are kept in a small pen with their mother for about a day.
And we purposely put them in a small enclosure like that so that they kind of learn what each other smells like. And the moms pick it up really quick. They recognize their baby by smell. They lick them off as soon as they're born, and then they'll recognize that baby.
Mother and lambs have numbered ear tags in case they get separated. This morning, some of the lambs and mothers are being moved to a larger pen so they can learn to get along in a larger flock. It makes for some noisy reunions.
This is trying to sort each other out. Yeah, are you my mom? No, you're not my mom. Are you my mom? No. Because the moms won't let them nurse if it's not their baby.
This is the 30th lambing season for Joan Ellison.
When we started, there were probably 5 people in the area within, you know, 5 or 10 miles of Pelican that raised sheep. And as far as I know, we're the only ones left.
As she watches the lambs, Joan Ellison spots a problem. One of the smaller lambs stands alone, looking miserable.
I'm going to go back in and make some milk up for little number 3. See how he's standing kind of hunched over? He's cold. That means he's not getting enough milk from his mom.
Every year, a couple of lambs are rejected by their mother, or they're too small to compete for a spot at the udder. To survive, they need to be fed with a bottle every 3 hours around the clock. When Ellison returns with a bottle of warm lamb formula, she kneels in the straw, cradles the lamb in her lap, and slips the nipple into his mouth.
There you go. It could be he's not as good a sucker as the others. And mom tends to walk away when he sucks because it hurts a little bit. Or it could be just because he's the littlest one in the family. Can you hear him nursing?
Lambing usually lasts about a month, and by the end, Joan Ellison says she's exhausted. But it's still a time of year she looks forward to, as the recent birth of quadruplets reminded her.
I found myself sitting on the floor in that pen just petting one of the babies, and I thought, oh, I obviously really enjoy this, you know. Because it can be a hard time, but it can also be an incredible time. Sometimes I think that you're more aware of being alive when you come out in the barn and there's a new baby and it's doing well. It's just this tremendous rush of emotion. It's a really good feeling.
Joan Ellison raises sheep primarily for the wool. She sells wool to knitters and spins her own yarn. Later this summer, most of the lambs will be sold for meat to Bosnian immigrants in Pelican Rapids. And next spring, the cycle will begin again. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Pelican Rapids.
And that's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, April 10th. I'm Perry Finelli. Thanks for listening.